Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Rebecca Cooney, Senior Features and Analysis Writer.
And I'm Emily Burt, Editor of Third Sector, the UK's leading publication for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector.
Each week we sit down for a quick-fire conversation about the interesting or unusual goings-on in the charity world.
And this week we're discussing the future of charity fundraising telethons. And we'll also be bringing you our coronavirus care package of good news stories later in the episode.
But first, what's the earliest television event you remember? So like that thing that you knew that everybody had seen, that you were sort of talking about the day after, and you sort of were aware of it being a shared experience, that you were watching it in real time with the rest of the nation?
For me, it was Princess Diana's funeral. I was in Sweden at the time, and I would have been 7 years old. I just remember sitting down with my mum and all my brothers and sisters and watching it and knowing that it was very sad, but not really knowing anymore because the voiceover was in Swedish, which I didn't speak. But yeah, I remember the kind of the procession going down the mall. That's my rather somber earliest TV memory. What about you?
Yeah, I think that's definitely up there, because I remember there being the 1 minute silence and my little brother being about five at the time and my dad sort of trying to explain to him that we had to be quiet for a minute. But then, of course, my brother being five going, why? And my dad being like, try to be silent. I'll explain to you later. And So I do remember that. But I think for me, probably it was just before that, it was the 1997 election, because I think that was about the first time that I worked out the Queen wasn't in charge of the country.
Fair.
Was when I saw these massive billboards with John Major's face on it. And that's all I remember. I don't remember the advertising. There's John Major's face, and then there were the New Labour, New Danger posters. We had like these eyes looking out of these kind of dark curtains, and I wasn't really clear what it was, but it was quite scary. Because I'd seen these posters, and because I'd sort of said to Mum, well, who's that man? And she's like, he runs the country. And I was like, not the Queen. What is this? So I kind of, you know, I was sort of interested. And yeah, I just remember the kind of the election coverage and the sort of, I must have been up quite late, because I remember the sort of celebrations and the things can only get better and that sort of thing. And then we asked around the office, we asked about this.
We did.
So yeah, Andy Ricketts was the 1979 Cup final.
The FA Cup final between Arsenal and Manchester United was Andy Ricketts's earliest TV memory.
Yep. And then for Stephen, it was the OJ Simpson car chase, which, yeah, I've never actually seen this. I have no memory of this. Whereas, yeah, he was like, oh, no, this is watching this live.
I can't stress enough that it was the most boring car chase in the history of all time, because it wasn't really a chase is a very explicit way, or like, I should say, a very exaggerated way of describing it, because he was crawling along at about 20 miles an hour. And there were just all these, you know, obviously panda cars and helicopters behind him. But it was more like a kind of a cavalcade, a sort of relaxed sort of drive around town rather than a chase. But yeah, that was a very, very big TV event. OJ Simpson.
So yeah, I mean, this was very much back in the day when, you know, if something was on TV in the evening, everybody was going to sit down and watch it, and you would be talking about it the next day at school, right? Like, or, you know,
absolutely
work or whatever. Like,
and yeah, it was the also a golden age. I mean, we're going to potentially dispute the fact that it was a golden age, but it was a big time as well for charity TV telethons. So we're going to talk about that now. So, according to the Museum of Broadcast Communications in the USA, the first telethon was broadcast by NBC in 1949. It was hosted by Milton Burley and it ran for 16 hours, raising $1.1 million for the Damon Runyon Memorial Cancer Fund.
That's quite impressive. Like, $1.1 million was a lot of money in the 40s. Like, that's really impressive.
1949, $1.1 million, not an insubstantial amount of cash. So the first annual telethon then launched in 1950, again in America, for United Cerebral Palsy. In the UK, when you're talking about telethons, it's very likely that the two that leap to mind are Comic Relief and BBC Children in Need. Children in Need launched in 1980, raising £1 million, and went on to raise a record £68.75 million in 2017.
Comic Relief started in 1985, and that was kind of the wild child of the charity world. Like, it had some of the biggest names in comedy at the time attached to it, and it had this reputation for edgy, irreverent humour. And the biennial Red Nose Day telethon has routinely raised more than £70 million ago.
And let's be clear, the amount of money being raised by these events isn't bad by any stretch of the imagination. £52 million to tackle poverty and hunger around the world, and £37 million to support children who need it. These are very impressive figures. But looking at them realistically and over time, these totals are falling. And that makes sense. The way we watch TV and consume media has changed drastically over the past 10 years. Like you were saying, Rebecca, remember when you were a kid and something interesting was on TV, the following day, everyone would have seen it and there would be lots to talk about. And it was, you know, TV was a kind of a big event back in the day. There was that sense of everyone watching something at the same time. And nowadays, we just don't do that unless it's line of duty. Television's not really an event anymore. It's content. And there's also so much to choose from. Maybe just one or two of the major TV channels have dedicated themselves to a telethon this evening. Okay, so that's fine. You can just binge something on Netflix. So with all that in mind, what does that mean for the future of the TV fundraiser?
So I did a very quick and dirty, utterly unscientific poll on Twitter this week.
the best kind of poll.
Yeah, absolutely. So we asked fundraisers how they thought telethons were doing. And just 17% said, actually, they're doing fine, not a problem. 26% said they were on their way out. And 57% said they needed to adapt to survive. So, yeah, what would this adaptation look like? In response to our poll, John Dean, who is a professor of politics and sociology at Sheffield Hallam University and who also does research on charities, he initially sort of said, no, they're doing fine. And then he kind of caveated it saying, considering the deep fracturing of how people consume media. So, you know, I asked him whether he thought there were any changes that could be made to deal with that fracturing. And yeah, he said he thought it would be pretty difficult, that if charities were to start partnerships with streaming services or social media, that content would be spread out and it wouldn't be a telethon in the same way. Which, yeah, I see what he's saying. And maybe that is kind of the point, right? But he also made a really interesting point that there's an issue about age, that Comic Relief and Children in Need are very much targeted towards children, as they can sort of spend 2 weeks doing build-ups to the event during school. And, you know, he points out that he remembers Comic Relief meaning a lot to him as a child, but he says, I don't know anyone in my age or generation who would watch them or talk about them now. And I have to say, I think the same is true for me. I haven't really engaged with Comic Relief in the same way since I was much younger. And I think some part of my brain always assumed that was because the content was sort of less good or less interesting. But yeah, actually, there are two variables there, right? The content has changed, but also I'm getting older and, you know, and I don't have kids. So I'm probably actually just falling in between the gap in that marketing, perhaps.
I completely agree. I absolutely remember Red Nose Day in school, especially in primary school. And you would have this big build up a week beforehand. Everyone would be going to the corner shop to buy their squeaky, very uncomfortable red noses. And there were slightly different themes to those red noses every single year.
Oh, you're right. They weren't actually that comfortable to wear. It's about an hour where you're like, this is great. And then after a while, people start to get these little red marks on their noses. Yeah.
The ridges over your nose. And you'd be like, my nose hurts.
Yeah, and they smelled weird as well. They always smelled like weird and plasticky. And
they
like,
smell absolutely shocking. But thankfully, Comic Relief now does fully organic red noses. I should say organic. They're made entirely from plant-based material now. So perhaps they smell better than they did back in the 90s, you would assume.
Here's hoping. Although, I mean, obviously, cowpats are made entirely from organic material and they don't smell great. But, you know, you never know. Hopefully they do smell less plasticky and weird.
That's not what the Comic Relief red noses are made out from now.
Absolutely no. And I mean to cast no aspersions on red noses.
The quality of the Comic Relief red nose is unparalleled. Please don't hurt us, Comic Relief.
Yeah. And no, they do look great. They do look absolutely great, some of the newer designs.
Oh, they're so good. But I actually went back to look at the red nose designs from the late 90s and the early 2000s when I would have been in primary school, and the memories they evoked, it's extraordinary. In 2001, the red nose had a face and like a little plastic tongue that extended when you squeezed the nose. It went like a party popper. And I just remember in school, so the gif was that not only would everyone be wearing a very uncomfortable, painful red nose on their faces, but you had the additional sensation of all the other kids coming up and squeezing the red nose on your nose to make the tongue poke out.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember those. And actually, do you know what the thing is? That is funny.
Yes.
Like and it's quite a childish humour, but yeah, that is funny. And the red nose thing, like for all we're saying uncomfortable, it is a good gag.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, it's not sophisticated. It's funny though, and I love it. I also, so Emily actually, yeah, bought up found a webpage that has all the kind of red nose designs through the years. And my favorite one was a color changing one from the mid 90s. So it would go from yellow to pink to red. And that is like proper mid 90s childhood, right? Like color changing technology being like the height of just coolness. Like mood rings were such a thing.
So sophisticated.
Yeah. Yeah. These little rings that can tell you what sort of mood you're in. Yeah, cheaper than therapy, I guess.
Get yourself a color-changing red nose.
Yeah. It's mindfulness in a ring. But yeah, like they were just like the height of cool when you were like six or seven. Like, yeah, they were brilliant. So clearly, I think as this kind of
slight deviation,
yeah, illustrates, these fundraisers have done a really good job at engaging with children and being part of children's childhood. But yet maybe there is a need to find ways to reach out to older, different audiences. I mean, obviously they're the ones that kind of, you know, that are forking out the money in the end as well.
The fundraiser Paul De Gregorio says this is something that telethon organisers are very aware of. He says they know they need to change as viewing habits are changing. They still make lots of money, but it is getting harder. But in the same tweet, he also pointedly included a picture from the One Love Manchester fundraiser, the concert that was held by Ariana Grande and others following the Manchester Arena bombings in 2017. The concert averaged 10.9 million viewers on BBC One, peaking at 14.5 million. And 22.6 million people watched at least 3 minutes of the programme, making it the UK's most watched television event of 2017. So, you know, that's a very, very fair point. The British Red Cross received £2.35 million in donations during the three-hour concert itself. And the following day, the charity said it had received £10 million since the bombing happened 2 weeks before. Because this was all part of a wider campaign, it is quite hard to tell whether later donations were prompted by the actual concert or just by the wider outpouring of support for the victims of the bombings. But still, it's not a bad total for something that was pulled together in less than 2 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had a similar example more recently with the Big Night In, which was organised in around a month in April 2020 and raised £27.4 million on the night to support those affected by the pandemic. And this was then doubled by the government under a match funding deal. So again, that's pretty impressive in a short space of time. So clearly there are times, moments, events that can capture the public's attention and make them want to tune in and be part of something connected, whether that's the response to a bombing or a response to, you know, the pandemic, which left us all feeling very disconnected, very scared, and we wanted to feel together. And maybe these telethon events are part of a coming together there.
Absolutely. So Paul De Gregorio's thoughts were that these events needed to follow the audience in terms of both the technology and the viewing platforms and the payment mechanisms that they use.
Yeah, and that payment mechanisms point is really interesting. So traditionally, a lot of income for these nights has come from text donations, you know, text give to this number to donate £10 or something like that. But the Phone Paid Services Authority, which regulates these kind of payments, said last year that it expects the market to reach saturation and begin to decline in the next few years. And that's actually quite easy to solve and adapt to, though, in fairness. We've got these mechanisms like PayPal and other online payment facilities, which we didn't have in the past, which are just that quick and easy and frictionless. It's not like, you know, the text thing arose in as a response to having to, you know, physically stop viewing something, pick up a phone and read your card number down the phone, or, you know, write a check and pop it in the post. And there are so many moments in there where people can get distracted, where they can, you know, change their mind and not give. So yeah, the text donations may be on their way out, but actually, you know, I think we are moving with the technology to find other ways of replacing that as a mechanism.
I completely agree. And there's also this issue about platforms and technologies. So if people aren't sitting down to watch live TV, what are they doing? They're on social media. They're on YouTube, they're streaming their entertainment, and they are listening to podcasts like ours.
Hi.
Hi. Oh dear. And we're seeing charities starting to figure out what this looks like. So in 2017, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, ran a live broadcast fundraising event. It was 4 hours long, which is relatively modest by telethon standards. But the key difference is that the event was not broadcast on TV. It was broadcast using Facebook Live. The event allowed the charity to reach fans and supporters on their social media, and it also helped them to open a dialogue around the key issues the ACLU works on. They were able to ping their supporters with reminders and get them to sign up to be notified when the stream started, which meant that people didn't have to sit down in front of the TV. It was right there on their phones, wherever they were. It also allowed for integration with Facebook donation tools. Again, getting that really frictionless process from the person thinking about donating to actually handing over the money. to the point where it generated more than $52,341 before it even went live. The evening raised more than $500,000, with $250,000 donated directly through Facebook live streams. It reached more than 2 million views and generated thousands of comments, shares, and likes. Interesting.
Kind of there is an alternative there. And, you know, closer to home, a lot of the sketches that Comic Relief produces as part of the live television event do work well as short videos on Facebook. So, for example, during the pandemic, have you seen any of Staged?
Yes.
Yeah, it's great. So it's David Tennant and Martin Sheen kind of playing themselves and sort of sending themselves up and sort of talking about being actors. But it's kind of, yeah, it is sort of short sketches. And they did a special one for Comic Relief, which worked really well. And then there's also No Such Thing as a Fish, which is the podcast run by the QI researchers. Really good podcast. And they did a 20-hour podcast recording for Comic Relief with different celebrities dropping in to join them. So that was streamed live on YouTube, but then smaller chunks of it were also available as podcast episodes. And then, of course, because it's on YouTube, you can go back and watch it later. So again, that's really meeting the audience where they are already. And you know, not it's all about me, but like, yeah. As an example, I didn't see any of the live telethon for Comic Relief this year, but I did engage with that content with the No Such Thing as a Fish, with the Stage, and I did donate as a result. So as an example, that is working there.
Right. And so Paul De Gregorio's other interesting comment was that there needs to be a focus on content with no room for filler. The focus there again is not about getting the audience to tune in because there will be some entertaining bits, but also that they get to be part of something as it's happening. And it's a good thing to do. It's about saying, here is something really compelling to watch. Oh, and by the way, it's for charity, so do feel free to donate.
So the example he gives for this is Stand Up To Cancer, which is a relative newcomer to the market. That launched in the UK in 2012 and raises money for Cancer Research UK. And like Comic Relief, it has a live event every 2 years. In 2018, the last time the event was run, it raised $24.6 million. But it also does stuff in its off years. So in 2019, there was no live telethon event, but it still raised $10.5 million. So what it does in the off years and alongside the live events is to piggyback onto existing programming. So for example, there have been special celebrity editions of popular shows like The Great British Bake Off. And that's been running recently. And it's, yeah, so it's taking shows that people like and giving them more of that, with a fundraising ask thrown in. So as you say, it's kind of, it's about the content coming first and then being like, oh, by the way, it's for charity, give some money.
So it definitely seems as though adaption is going to mean getting things much more diffuse. It becomes a campaign, a season of programming, events, content, participation opportunities, rather than one central night. Post-COVID, I wonder if we all might be more literate in this idea of accessing short live broadcast events or recordings of events that have been filmed previously. I mean, you know, if you think about the success of the National Theatre's broadcasts of some of its shows, for example, they were wildly popular. People were willing to pay to experience something that they couldn't reach live and something that they might have otherwise missed out on. And maybe there will be the opportunity for charities to engage with that post-pandemic. And there's like a nice accessibility question around that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously during the pandemic, you know, the National Theatre were very much raising money for themselves because they needed it, you know. But yeah, I wonder if post-pandemic that idea could be harnessed. So those are, again, much shorter events, but there is still a platform where people are still willing to tune in live and stick around for a long period of time. And so that's live game streaming. And Emily, I think this is something you've dipped your toe into.
Not live streaming so much, but I've definitely lost hours of my life to watching streams of people playing Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild on the Nintendo Switch. It's an amazing game.
And what's the appeal of watching somebody else play? Is it just that you get the stories without the kind of having to try and jump up a wall four times and fail?
I think partly that, but also that there are elements of kind of, I mean, this game in particular, it's an open world game. So there are so many things that you can still learn that you never find out yourself, and you can go and watch other people doing it. And it's just like, oh, wow. I'm explaining this really badly, but everyone makes that game their own. There's a massive, you know, plot to it and all the rest of it. For me, I tend to spend most of my time actually playing the game, riding horses and cooking.
Living the dream.
So it's quite nice to watch people actually, yeah, just trying to defeat the bosses. And I'm just like, oh, I'm going to make a special soup with these pumpkins that I've gathered somewhere up a mountain. I don't know. but also a lot of these gamers are actually very funny as well. So there's a comedic element to it a lot of the time. It can be entertaining in just a not especially taxing way. So a typical gaming live stream will allow the viewer to see the gamer's face and the game in real time. And during a fundraising stream, the streamer completes a challenge such as playing for a set amount of time or doing a speed run where they try to complete a game as fast as possible. And all the while they will be promoting the charity to their followers and urging them to donate. So, for example, the fastest Breath of the Wild speed run I've seen is takes less than half an hour. It was around 28 minutes to complete, which is pretty incredible to me because it took me about a year to get to the final boss of the game. Probably because I was cooking pumpkins up a mountain, you know, for most of it.
I mean, that does sound like the dream, right? I get to live up a mountain,
tame horses,
cook nice food and ride horses. Yeah, I mean, that's actually kind of my perfect life.
And it's just, it is lovely to look at as well. I mean, visually, but I'm getting distracted. But
yeah, sorry.
So during a live stream, gamers will hold auctions, they'll hand out prizes, and they will incentivize viewers to donate with different reward tiers. The streams often involve the host playing video games for hours on end, and it's a lucrative space to harness. The global gaming industry was worth $137.9 billion in 2018, according to the gaming analytics company Newzoo. In the UK alone, an estimated 37.3 million people are gamers, and the UK games industry generated £3.5 billion in 2018. So live streams on Twitch and YouTube have become the most common way for charities to harness the fundraising power of gaming, with Twitch estimating that more than $100 million was raised through the platform between its launch in 2011 and 2019. And again, we've got those instant payment options. So one really interesting example of a streaming event that had a massive reach was in January 2019, when a well-known YouTuber, H-Bomber Guy, real name Harry Brewis, had launched a live stream Twitch challenging himself to play Donkey Kong for 24 hours. Again, genius, just tapping into that 90s nostalgia. Everyone remembers Donkey Kong on the Nintendo. Great game. Vintage, iconic. And he played it while encouraging viewers to donate to Mermaids, a charity that supports young transgender people. So the campaign went viral. It drew support from the likes of the Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the singer and actor Cher, and the journalist Owen Jones. AOC, for example, actually asked to be patched in and to appear on the live stream to show her support. So by the time Brewis completed the game, his stream had raised more than £275,000 for the charity. It's not the biggest amount of money, but for Mermaids, which is quite a small organisation, it was game-changing. It also raised a huge amount of awareness and helped to create support for trans rights issues, which is also a huge part of what telethons do as well.
Yeah, and the thing is with that one is that the charity didn't really know it was happening until it started. So they got involved and they spoke to Brewis and they offered him support on the day. But this event got planned and started and took off without any real effort on the charity's part. And, you know, it used to be the case that if you wanted to reach millions of people, you needed a fully equipped TV studio and a partnership with a network. You needed people to come around the phone banks. You know, you need all of that. It was a huge and expensive undertaking. Now, what you need is a camera and an internet connection. You know, in the most basic possible way, you could actually do it with your phone. Yes, okay, you can buy more equipment and make it look better. That's completely possible. But we are literally carrying the equipment for a telethon around in our pockets, which means there are so many more opportunities for the public to get involved and to be contributing their own content. And this might mean less control for the charities in the long term, and that might not actually be a bad thing. So one thing we've been hearing a lot over the last few years with fundraising is how charities need to start thinking of themselves as working in partnership with supporters to solve a problem. And that's sometimes going to be about allowing supporters to come up with ideas for content and then to manage it themselves. And then the charity's role becomes to curate that content and flag it up to other supporters rather than being seen to own it. So the fundraising consultant Lisa Harwood is really keen on this idea. You know, in the past, she's pointed to the Ice Bucket Challenge and even the Me Too movement as examples of campaigns that were started and very much owned by the public and then curated by charities and campaign bodies. People didn't sit around and have a focus group and decide to do these things. They sort of started spontaneously and took off. And I do think it might be possible to apply this logic to live broadcasting events, that you get these smaller, more diffuse events created by the public, which all have the potential to go viral and could raise significant sums of money, even if the central event actually pulls in less than it used to, or even actually if there is no central event. So going back to Stand Up to Cancer, they were supposed to have one of their sort of on year for having the live television event was 2020, and in the end they had to cancel it, but they still did a whole host of programming, and I'm not sure how much they raised, but you know, I think they still managed to, you know, it wasn't a complete dead loss for them. So maybe we have this central fundraising event as the kind of the central hub around which everything else kind of operates, or you don't have it at all and it is this much more diffuse thing.
Right. So it might be that the massive on the night live event totals that we used to get will become a thing of the past. But there are still opportunities to create this connection, this focus on a cause, and to generate funds. And I think it's going to be exciting to see what this looks like in the future.
Absolutely. And these were just some of our thoughts, some thoughts that we kind of cribbed off Twitter. Tell us if we're wrong, or tell us if your charity is doing something really interesting in this space. We'd be really, really keen to hear it, because I think, like Emmy says, it's going to be really exciting to see what happens. I think there are lots of different directions it could go in. So yes, do get in touch with us at Third Sector on Twitter. Let us know.
Each week, we are bringing you a mini coronavirus care package, a good news story that we've spotted in the sector. What have we got, Rebecca?
So this week, first up, we've got the lovely story of 9-year-old Esme from Crawley Down. So we've had quite a few kind of, kids getting involved in fundraising. I think that's really lovely that there is no upper or lower age limit to fundraising. So Esme has set herself the challenge of running 2.3 kilometres every day throughout May to raise funds for a local children's hospice, which is the Chestnut Tree House. She's been getting up at 7 a.m. every morning and going for a run with her dad before school. And she's picked this distance because it's the distance of sort of the triangle of roads around where she lives. So essentially she's running around the block for 2.3 kilometres every day. Her mum, Naomi, says she isn't a keen runner, so this is a big challenge for her, which I find mind-blowing. I hear this all the time from people who do these amazing distances. I was speaking to Kathy Dean, who's the chief exec of Save the Rhino UK, and she does ultra marathons.
Yeah.
And she was like, so she joined the charity having never done a run before. Save the Rhino UK make a lot of money from marathons. And she sort of said, well, I better run the London Marathon. So the following year, she ran the London Marathon. The year after that, she does the Marathon des Sables, which is basically six marathons in six consecutive days across the Sahara Desert in Morocco. And then at the end of the interview, she sort of says, oh, yeah, I still don't love running, but, it's good.
It must be a mindset thing, because I don't like running, and so I just don't run.
Yeah, that is how I solve that problem. So, hats off to Kathy Dean, hats off to Esme for having a lot more determination and willpower than I will ever possess, I think. Esme said she chose this charity because she thought that they offer a really important service, and she said they need so much money to fund it, so I thought I could help them raise the money. The children are safe there and it gives their carers a break. So far, she's raised £165, and she's got a fundraising page at justgiving.com/fundraising/Naomi-Teasdale2. Teasdale is TEASDALE, and obviously Naomi's her mum's name. So yeah, if you fancy giving for that, and we'll put links in the show notes to that under the news story on our website. Good luck, Esme. Keep going. It's awesome, and we are in awe.
Wonderful, Esme. Keep on going.
So next up, I've got one which I think is going to be quite close to your heart, Emily.
Is it about a whale?
It's not a whale. It isn't a whale. No, it is about weddings.
Ooh. Okay, well, if it's weddings and it's good news, then I'll take it. Hit me.
You can cope with it. Okay, it is good news. It's okay. This is the Teesdale-based autism charity, Daisy Chain, ran a competition. Basically, it was a fundraising competition, and the winner would get effectively their wedding paid for.
Nice.
The package of prizes included a wedding at Hardwick Hall as their hotel venue, with catering and an overnight stay with a bridal breakfast. So Hardwick Hall, I used to go on school trips there. It's like this proper like Tudor castle. Like I think Bess of Hardwick Hall or Elizabeth was like the lady there, and she was kind of a big deal in the Elizabethan court. You've definitely seen this place like in period dramas, Tudor costume drama things. You will have seen it. It's this impressive kind of Tudor castle. And they kind of get a sort of choice of wedding date, a wedding dress provided by the Bridal Factory outlet in Northallerton, the hair done, groom's suits, groomsmen's suits, wedding cars, photography, flowers, bridal nails, and 3-month couples gym membership as well afterwards, which it feels like getting your marriage off to a rocky start, but all right. That's also included. So yeah, so they had this was the prize, and basically the couples had to raise money for the charity in order to have a chance of winning. So if you raised 500 quid, you got a place in the raffle. And so a couple, Rebecca Baldwin and Sam Wagner, raised more than £1,600 for the charity, which qualified them for 3 tickets in the raffle, and their name was drawn out of the raffle. A runners-up, Kayleigh Sterling and Anthony Murray, received a consolation prize of a stay at Ramsgate Hall's tree houses with spa access as well. So also a nice prize. But yeah, effectively you had to raise as much money as possible for the charity in order to maximise your chance of winning. In total, the charity raised just over £4,000.
Wonderful. That's brilliant.
So yeah, so nice one. And yeah, the stress of just all of that being sorted sounds really nice, actually, I have to say.
Sure does.
Having done the whole wedding planning thing.
I hope it's able to go ahead stress-free, and it's a wonderful day.
Yeah, it's not until 2022, so best of luck to Rebecca and Sam.
That's nice. That's a good amount of run-in. Okay, good luck, Rebecca and Sam.
And also good luck to anyone at all who might be having a wedding sooner. It will be fantastic, and you'll have a fantastic time. It will be lovely.
Sure, I hope so. We'll be back with another episode soon, so make sure you subscribe to this, the Third Sector podcast, on your favourite podcast app to be the first to know about it. Until then, I'm Emily Burt.
And I'm Rebecca Cooney.
And our producer is Lindsay Riley at Rethink Audio. We will see you next week.